just doing a small part of trying to make our climbing communities more equal and healthy and letting more people in the room, there's so much more for not just the climbing community, but the wider community. This is what I'm carrying with me, and this is why I've created Mental, and our tagline is to be climbers who care and to really champion this idea of a culture who cares.
Hi and welcome to episode 182 of Pinweg Bouldern. I am Juliane Fritz and my guest is the climber and medical doctor and founder Nabiha Razak. And Nabiha had this question. What do refugees need that arrive in the EU on Lesbos, and how can climbing help them in their situation? She quit her job as a doctor, started a van life and climbing life, and she founded an organization called Mental, Climbing for Wellbeing in Greece on the island Lesbos, where she's living at the moment. On this island, a lot of refugees arrive that want to go further to Europe. They are living in an uncertain situation. They don't know whether they will get asylum or not. Giving them the mental skills to get through this situation is what Nabiha is trying to do. And I want to talk to her about this plan. Before the interview starts, I would like to inform you about my podcast crowdfunding. For this podcast, I use the platform Steady. On Steady, you can become a member of my podcast and support me with an amount of money that you can choose. And I thank all the people that are taking part and help me producing this podcast. If you want to check it out, you'll find the link in the show notes and on my website. Thank you for your help. And now let's start listening to Nabiha. Hello, Nabiha.
Hi, Juliane. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thank you for taking the time. And I know you are in Greece right now. Maybe you can tell us a little bit where you are right now. Maybe also where you are climbing.
Yeah, so currently I'm based on the island of Lesbos. It's just 12 kilometers away from the coast of Turkey. So actually I'm closer to Turkey than I am to mainland Greece. And I'm on the island now with my husband and our van. So we are climbing on the island. There isn't a lot of climbing, but there's a lot of potential to really grow the climbing areas here.
And what I already heard from you is that you had a long journey from quitting your job as a doctor in Ireland, going to Lebanon to help the people there with the organization Climb Aid, and now you are starting something new in Greece. So let us at first get to know you and find out what made you choose this way. Why did you leave that job as a doctor? And why did you want to work in a nonprofit climbing organization?
Right. I was working as a doctor in Ireland, and I was working in the field of child and adolescent psychiatry. At that point, I have been climbing for about 10 years, and I've always been passionate about mental health, and I always felt that psychiatry would be the path forward for me. However, while I was working in the clinical setting, I found myself being drawn to more community-based approaches to mental health, but also taking a step back and thinking about mental health beyond just treating mental illness, but also thinking about what makes someone healthy. And also at that time, there was definitely a part of me that was burnt out, working during the pandemic, just feeling like a cog in this wheel. And we did what everyone did at that time who was going through that existential crisis. We bought a van, my husband and I, and we started volunteering places, just getting to know different communities. And that's actually how we found ClimAid. And that actually gave us then the reason to move to Lebanon and see how it would be possible to merge my two passions of climbing and mental health.
So is your husband working in the same field as you?
He was not. So he was actually working in corporate, in the gaming industry, but we both quit our jobs. I think we were both feeling like we wanted to change and we wanted to do more with our lives. And currently he is working, he's transitioned into the nonprofit sector, and he's working with an organization called Yoga and Sports for Refugees, that is based on Lesbos. And that's also how we ended up on Lesbos. But he also founded Mental with me. So he's my partner on this project as well.
Yeah. So he's doing a little bit what you are doing, but not with climbing, but with yoga.
not really, it's a misleading name because it is called Yoga and Sports with Refugees, but they don't just do yoga. What they do is they run this open community gym where people can practice all kinds of sports. And I guess when they start, there was a big focus on yoga and mental health, but now they just run all kinds of sports. And there is a climbing gym there, and he is also a climber. Mm-hmm. So we definitely share that passion.
Okay. And can you tell me, before you were doing the work that you're doing right now, did you have any experience that showed you how climbing could work for people and their mental stability? So did you do that like in Ireland before?
So when I was working in Ireland, I was working in an inpatient unit. So this is a unit where really sick children or teenagers were admitted for more intensive care and treatment. My main role was kind of supporting the doctors there who are like reviewing the diagnoses and medication. And it really kind of showed me how for mental health, you really need to have a multidisciplinary approach, right? So like when you're in this intensive care, it's not just a doctor, but you're working with nutritionists, physiotherapists, nurses, and it's really just a whole mix of professionals. And it really kind of laid this idea that our well-being is so interconnected. It's not just our biology, but it's the experiences we've had, the circumstances we're in, and there's so many different approaches to supporting someone's mental health. And when I was there, I felt that I was really drawn to the occupational therapist specifically, because I felt that the question that they were asking resonated the most with me, which was, what makes your life worth living and how can we get you back to that place? And a lot of what the occupational therapists did were engaging people in activities, so bringing the kids outside, doing group sessions, just giving them opportunities that allowed them to participate in life and to try new things. And I think climbing very much has that same approach, and I find it just as life-affirming, where you have this problem that you're trying to face, and it happens to be a colorful one, so it makes it less intimidating, but it's still a problem nonetheless. You're learning to understand your limits, you're learning to be okay with falling and getting back up, and you're doing it with the support of others, which I think is a really beautiful metaphor for life. And when I was working in Ireland, even though there was a lot of research on the benefits of bouldering psychotherapy done by Prof. Katharina Luttenberger, and that was kind of mostly based in like Germany and Austria, there wasn't a lot of that kind of opportunity in Ireland. But I mean, I think many climbers will relate when they can understand how climbing can be such a tool for your mental health. But interestingly enough, just 2 weeks ago, the Irish Journal of Psychological Medicine published their results of a research that they did using climbing therapy on adults with depression. And this was very much based on Professor Katharina's research on bouldering psychotherapy.
Did you read something new for yourself there?
No, I mean, like, I've been a believer of this for a long time, and I was very familiar with Prof. Luttenberger's work, definitely. And yeah, basically, they were just trying to replicate the same methods and the results in the Irish context. And it's just really interesting to know that this is coming into like the sphere that I was working in. Something that I could not have imagined when I was working in that field before. It's so nice that it's being picked up by climbers who also happen to be researchers or psychologists.
Mm. Yeah. Can you give us a little bit more insights into this question? What makes your life worth living? Or was it the way you said it?
Yeah.
So can you give us some ideas what it means to a person that has a mental illness?
Yeah, I mean, I suppose when I was working in medicine, a lot of my job was managing crisis. So like as a doctor in the psychiatry setting, you're kind of dealing with someone who wants to end their life, let's say, and your main role is just to keep them alive long enough so the medication kicks in. In an ideal world where we have all of the resources and all of the support and a robust mental health system, I'm sure my role as a doctor would also be so much more than that. But at the time that I was working, which was also during the pandemic, there was also this huge surge of mental illness. And I just felt like the question I was always asking was, Oh, do you want to end your life? How can we keep you safe? And it's keeping people alive against their will in some ways. And obviously, you have to. And medication takes time to kick in. And it can be really heavy, obviously, working with that day in, day out, and just being part of the crisis management and not part of the kind of longer term support. Working in the more like institutional, longer term settings, like an inpatient unit, where you get to work on different things to make them feel better. That question of like, okay, how can we get you out of here? The question that needed to be asked is, okay, what makes your life worth living? What makes you want to live and not just like talking about the symptoms, like how bad do you feel today? Do you still want to end your life? Like all of these difficult questions that you need to ask to assess for risk and to manage. But it can also be really tiring to only have those conversations. And I think the approach to mental health that also asks this question, that what makes a society, a healthy society to live in? Where is the context that this individual we are treating? What is the context that they came from? And what were the preventative things within that context that could have prevented this current presentation? And so I think that's what I mean when I talk about community-based approaches to mental health, but also more like life-affirming. So not just keeping you safe, keeping you alive, but actually working with you to have a life that's really worth living, that you would want to keep living.
No.
You can imagine that doing something like climbing could be very tactile, could take you out of the box of, I have depression and this is how I deal with it, and puts it in this more neutral, playful setting while still allowing you to work with the tools you need to manage your depression, which is the basis of kind of bouldering psychotherapy, is combining climbing as the vehicle and then using lessons learned through cognitive behavioral therapy that people do in clinics all the time, just taking that out into a real life setting where they get to experience problem solving in real life rather than just talking about it. And they get to experience how they, as a person, react to problems. And then having that experience using then evidence-based research of how cognitive behavioral therapy works and putting it in this real life context and then replaying it. I think that's basically the methodology behind interventions like bouldering psychotherapy or climbing therapy.
Can you tell me, did you have any qualification as a climbing coach or as a mental trainer in climbing that helped you to get into this field of climbing and mental health?
Yeah, so I would say my entry to the field is a little less direct. So, like I said, I've been climbing for about 10 years, and I started bouldering indoors when I was in medical school in Ireland at the time. That kind of led to me climbing outdoors. I did return to Malaysia, and I also climbed competitively for my country. So I've had like a lot of experience of climbing in different settings. And before continuing my work in psychiatry, I also trained in like trauma-informed psychotherapy, and more recently, training in the design of mental health programs from a public health lens. So I feel like I've always been interested in how to apply climbing in these contexts. And I think when I was training and when I was working, I didn't really see how that could be directly applicable. So I was finding the ways kind of tangentially related to it. Like I knew I wanted to work with communities that are dealing with trauma. And so I kind of went a little bit in that path. And I know I want to now work in understanding how do we design good mental health programs? How do we know they're like evidence-based and all of these things? So I'm kind of taking the more medical approach and then using my experience in climbing as well as my own like personal affinities to merge the two worlds together.
Ah, and I didn't know that you were a comp climber too. How long did you do that?
That was about a year. And that was like in my early 20s in Malaysia.
Ah, okay, so you are from Malaysia.
Yeah.
Ah, okay. Now you are in Greece, you are starting this program, Mental, and I guess you take some of the experiences from Lebanon into this new work, as I said in the introduction that you work there for ClimAid. At first, how did you experience the situation in Lebanon as a person that lived there?
Yeah. So I feel like it's impossible to talk about Lebanon without just talking about the state of Lebanon currently and just having some context. But I'll also go another step backwards to just talk about how I heard of Lebanon and how I ended up there, which was I stumbled on a climbing guidebook, and I find it so interesting how climbing can give us this lens to experience different cultures and countries. And in this guidebook, I saw that there were so many like really beautiful crags in Lebanon, and that was also how I heard about climate in that book. So for a small country, it really is full of contradictions. And I guess even the background of Lebanon, like this is a country that has been through an economic crisis, just like in the past few years, like the economic crisis, they had this big Beirut port explosion on top of that. They dealt with the pandemic like the rest of the world, and currently the war and ongoing displacement. And Lebanon is also a country that hosts up to like an estimated 1.5 million Syrian refugees, and 9 in 10 of them live in extreme poverty. So this was the population that I was also working really closely with. And Lebanon is a really small country. For anyone that doesn't know Lebanon, you could drive from the south to the north of Lebanon in like 4 hours, and that's like the whole country. Mm-hmm. So when I was there, I experienced like the beautiful climbing, the amazing mountains, the really like lively climbing community. They have an amazing climbing festival that they do every year. If you haven't heard of Climber Space, you should really check them out. And they do all of these amazing things on the background of their everyday reality, which is living a really uncertain life. Like, it's so hard to make any plans in Lebanon because you have no idea if Israel is going to bomb the country in the next week, or where the war is going to go, or how are you going to travel? Is the airspace going to be closed? Like, I feel like the reality of people in Lebanon is always uncertainty, and we keep going because this is our reality.
Mm. And what did you see there? What issues did the people deal with?
So I would also preface that to say that I was in this small little village called the Bekaa Valley, and it's close to this city called Zahleb. It's very Christian. Lebanon is a country with so many different sects and religions. You have your Muslims, you have your Jews, your Christians, and you're all living together. But that obviously also creates points of differences. And just where I was living and where we were doing a lot of our work, there was a lot of Syrian refugees that were in that area. And even though Syria and Lebanon are so like culturally similar, and even geographically they're so close, but a lot of Syrians, because of the Syrian war, were displaced in Lebanon. A lot of the issues that a lot of my friends dealt with day-to-day, identity, right? Trying to figure out who your identity is, who are you, what gives me value. There's a very real discrimination aspect. So as similar as you could say Syrians and Lebanese are culturally, there's still a huge discrimination among the Syrians because they are refugees at the end of the day. They are not in their own country. And there is a lot of stigma around that as well. And that brings with it, obviously, like lack of opportunities, lack of resources, living in a country that faced the economic crisis as well. Like, it's been really difficult for generations, on top of the civil war before that. So it's just a country like filled with so much. It has been through a lot, and you feel that very much in even till today. I guess one thing that I remember most in this small part of Lebanon that I was working in was that there still very much was a big difference between genders and the value of a man versus a woman, mm-hmm. and the limitations of what a woman could do versus a man. Like, some girls couldn't come to the climbing wall without having their brothers with them. Girls were still very much shouldn't be seen outside of the house. Like, this was a belief that some families still very much hold closely. And I think that was something that maybe surprised me the most. Mm-hmm. And again, to preface that this is not the experience of every Lebanese or Syrian person that I worked with when I was there, and definitely not the experience of all Lebanese people in different parts of Lebanon, like Beirut, which is your big city. So yeah, it's really hard to generalize because mm-hmm. for such a small place, there is so many different layers of privilege that exist in Lebanon alone, and so many different experiences because of that.
Yeah. So when you are working in such a situation, I can imagine that you are always trying to figure out in your head, so what's the one thing I can do that like helps not just one, but maybe a few of these problems. So did you think like that?
In that moment, when I first arrived there, I think my expectation was just to share my love of climbing and how climbing has helped me personally. Like, I am a very introspective person, and I felt like climbing has been a way that I have been able to really understand my psyche, really show me how I talk to myself, how I face problems. And I just wanted to share that with the people I met. But also, I just wanted to experience climbing in this very different culture and context. I wanted to understand how other people experience climbing, especially when you don't have as many resources or opportunities as people in maybe in the European context, let's say. And I was really curious about, what can climbing do in the context of poverty, discrimination, war? And I think that was the main question that was in my mind, rather than what can I do. I think it was more, what can climbing do?
When you go there from Europe, coming from Europe and being able to travel there to go climbing and see the situation of the people there, like, what does that do to you?
I think the question of privilege is very much something that weighs really heavily on me. I understand that, I had the privilege to travel from Europe. I had the privilege to pursue an education. I had the privilege, like, I am very aware of the privileges that I have. And then being able to travel to Lebanon to experience their different culture, to experience their climbing. I feel like the only thing that comes to my mind right now is I'm just like flooded with images of all of the people I met there, all of the climbers, and how happy they were that we wanted to travel all the way to Lebanon to experience Lebanese culture, to experience Lebanese climbing and the Lebanese community. Like, that was more the central experience for me, how open and excited they were to share this thing that they're so proud of, that they should be really proud of, with more people. And I think the only time the kind of privilege question really stood out for me in an existential way was when we could leave, more than when we could enter the country. So when I left Lebanon with my husband, it was when the war in Lebanon was heightening and it was spreading beyond the south of Lebanon, very much to the central of Lebanon. Like, we were having, we could hear bombs being dropped like a kilometer away from where we were living. And I had recently as well, the day before that, gotten into a motorbike accident.
You had an accident?
Yeah, I got into a motorbike accident and I had to have surgery done on my face as well. And it was definitely a moment where I felt like I needed to get out. I needed to go somewhere where I felt safe. And in that moment, I very much felt the privilege of being able to leave, the guilt of leaving my team behind, the struggle, I suppose, of putting myself first and my needs, and also being so aware that a lot of people who have more medical needs than I had at that moment as a direct result of the war probably could not evacuate to get further medical support. So I think that was the only time that the privilege really hit me, was when I was able to leave.
Yeah.
Because I feel as well, a lot of Lebanese are so proud of Lebanon and love Lebanon. And whenever I speak to my friends and I say, like, do you ever imagine living somewhere else in Europe? A lot of them, not everyone, obviously, and a lot of Lebanese people have roots in France. A lot of them want to stay in Lebanon and love Lebanon. So I feel like that question of, like, Oh, I was able to travel from Europe to go to Lebanon. Wasn't the biggest question there because everybody was like, "Oh yeah, of course you'll come all the way to you from Europe to experience Lebanon. It's like the most special place in the world for them, you know?" And I guess it's only in these times of war that you ask yourself, like when safety is in the question, that idea of privilege comes in. And I think that's the kind of common thread. Nobody wants to leave their homeland. If they leave, it's because safety. It must have been life and death, you know.
Okay, so let's get back to my questions about Lebanon. Did you see that there were any other resources for young people to get help? So, any other activities they could do when they have problems with their mental health?
Yeah, I think there are a lot of organizations that exist on the ground, and Lebanon definitely has that, and these were all organizations that offer like medical aid, health, even psychology services, mental health. You also had your basic psychosocial services, so those are like art activities, or even there was like a big a concierge, which is like a French organization that did like circus and these kind of things that indirectly also supports the well-being of people who are displaced. There were also sports like football and basketball that were there as well. So we were definitely not the only activity that was provided, but yeah, definitely a really special one.
And can you describe me what you saw? How does climbing make a change for those young people that you work with?
I think what stayed with me is just this idea of the climbing wall being like a third space, right? Like a kind of like a safe, neutral ground for people to coexist. So you would have like when you're there at the wall, you're kind of there as a climber. And this is an oversimplification of the experience, and it obviously wasn't this every single time, but it did provide an opportunity or a space for people to just exist on the same level. And I think it was a really powerful way to challenge certain beliefs that maybe people held just because that was all they've been exposed to, or that was what their family believed, or that was the culture of the people around them. And having this space where, for example, a girl could climb a problem that a guy could climb, which sounds really simple, but in the context of where we were, was a nice way to not directly say to someone, women are the same as men, or women should have equal rights to men. But it was just a really nice way to allow that kind of messaging to exist, to take up space. That, yeah, there's so many things about climbing that challenges that kind of gender norms, that maybe a girl would approach this problem differently because they use their flexibility or they're more controlled when they're climbing versus men who think that, and again, overgeneralization, like some of the guys who would just want to climb with power, needing to use like more of their technique. There's a lot of power in that, just existing with different ideas and making space for different ideas that challenges some beliefs that you have. And climbing is just such a beautiful tool to do that with.
And are there any experiences that you made in Lebanon that will stay in your mind and that you would want to talk about here?
Yeah, we had a climbing competition, and this climbing competition brought climbers from all over Lebanon, like the big cities. There was even climbers from Jordan that traveled to compete in this competition. And it was important because at that time, Syrian refugees could not compete in national competitions because they didn't have the residencies, and they obviously didn't, they weren't Lebanese nationals. So it was a really nice platform or opportunity for Syrian climbers to be able to compete with like the best climbers in Lebanon, and even when there were international climbers that came. And the competitions were always so amazing. And I remember specifically one of our strongest climbers. Like he's won the competition like the years before, so we were all rooting for him. But this year he was climbing with a swollen ankle that he's injured a few days before from football. And so, you know, we were definitely like rooting for him, but we could see like he was in pain. And he made it into the finals. And when he was in the final route, like, I still remember this moment of him finishing the route, even with his swollen ankle. Like, he really pushed through to get to the top, and everyone was cheering for him. And I definitely, like, got so emotional, because that moment just signified, just having everyone in the room, even his competitors, like, cheering him on, right? It's this power of climbing to, like, just bring people together, even if we are all competing against the same problem. When someone gets to the top, it very much feels like our victory as well, that, like, we can share in that joy because we know what that struggle feels like. And, like, this moment was so much more than just some guy who got to finish a fun problem at a wall. Like, this whole moment was, like, informed by the context of him being a Syrian refugee who was born in a camp in Lebanon. You know, he had so much to pull from. Like, this moment, like, I'm not going to speak on his behalf, but, like, I'm sure it meant so much to him. And it meant so much to all of us. It became our moment alongside him. And I think that's a nice metaphor about what climbing can do in the right situations and how relatable it can be regardless of what path you've taken to get there.
And can you tell me, what did you learn yourself in Lebanon? Has it changed personal perspectives or has it changed the way you see climbing?
Yeah, so I feel like my time in Lebanon has reinforced for me that there is a place and role for climbing within different cultures and different lived experiences, that it offers you this space to connect with people with completely different lived circumstances as you. And I think that's really important, to be able to coexist alongside each other. And I think people talk a lot about the power of climbing to bring people together, to experience joy, and all of these really positive things. And I understand that climbing isn't a perfect sport. And as much as I believe 100% climbing is this beautiful way to move forward with life, it still doesn't remove a lot of the structural issues that we have, that people face, such as racism and discrimination and poverty and trauma and all of these systemic problems. And it certainly doesn't stop war or remove the inequities that exist in the world. And I think a lot of people ask, like, what does this have to do with climbing? You know, we're just here to have fun, we're just climbing. But for me, these two things are inseparable. I think climbing is like a microcosm, you know, it is its own culture on its own. It can be almost like a cult, you know, we have our, like, community, there are these values. And if your climbing community is not diverse and it doesn't have lots of different people existing in it, it represents the wider kind of society that you exist in, I think. And, you know, you have to ask the question, like, why are some people not getting in? Like, who decides who gets to belong in these spaces, who should be part of it? And I think this is the thing that I've brought from Lebanon that's carried into my work in mental, is this idea that our climbing communities can reflect our wider societal issues and societal structures. And just doing a small part of trying to make our climbing communities more equal and healthy and diverse and representative, and letting more people in the room, does so much more for not just the climbing community, but the wider community. Yeah, this is what I'm carrying with me, and this is why I've created Mental, and our tagline is to be climbers who care and to really champion this idea of a culture who cares.
How I understand you now is that we can practice this in all of our little climbing communities, what you've learned.
Yeah, for sure.
We are going to Greece now to the new project you are starting.
Yeah.
So with what you've learned in Lebanon, you are starting this project called Mental. So it's about mental health and also about the move, mental, the mentally move.
Yeah.
This is a kind of a word play, word game. And what you have learned in Lebanon, you are using now also to start this new project on Lesbos, where a lot of refugees arrive in the EU and they are waiting in camps for an acceptance of their asylum application. And I must say, Lesbos is not so much in the news here right now. What can you tell us? What is the situation of the refugees there right now?
Yeah, maybe before I go into this very depressing topic, I can give you a fun fact. I just wanted to go into what we were talking about, the name Mental. And so we're called Mental, but, you know, it's spelled M-N-T-L. So we removed the vowels. So it could mean to mental, which is the movement, but then also mental health, obviously. But I think it's also, I just like the symbolic idea of mentaling. So for people who don't know what that is, it is this idea of this movement where you kind of put all of your weight on your two hands and then you bring your feet up. It's similar to getting out of the pool, but it also kind of signifies when you're topping out at the end of a boulder. So it kind of signifies this last moment of getting over a boulder, which is a little bit like a metaphor of like whatever problems that we're facing, being able to get on top of it. So that's kind of like the idea behind the name. And also because it's easier than naming the organization Traverse or Beta or some other climbing word, because we went through every climbing word trying to connect it. But it also has that nice imagery. So that's a little fun.
Not true.
But back to Lesbos. So yeah, Lesbos is very much a hot spot in when the refugee crisis started in 2016. A lot has happened since then, just a whirlwind summary of everything. There was one of the big things in the news that people might have heard about was this big fire of the Moria camp. So the area where the initial camp was held was called Moria. There was this big fire that happened. They built a transitionary camp to move people from Moria. And this camp is right by the sea. So for people who don't know, a lot of refugees that arrive in Lesbos, they arrive by boat from Turkey. I said we were 12 kilometers away from Turkey, so it's the closest point to Europe. They usually are overloaded on dinghies, which are these like inflatable boats filled up to the brim with more people than it should be filled with. A lot of people drown at sea. A lot of people disappear. And a big practice that happens at sea is this thing called pushbacks, where Greek authorities are at sea looking for people who are making this journey, pushing them back to Turkish waters or pushing them back to the sea, hoping that they don't arrive on Greece. So that is a very well-known practice that happens. And so this current camp that they're in is right next to the sea, the same sea that they have to traverse to get to Europe. A lot of people make this journey 6-7 times and fail and still keep coming back because this is their only option for safety, security, a future, new life. And the big news at the moment in Lesbos, not just in the moment, it's been for the past 2-3 years, where they are building a new camp. They call it like a controlled access center, and it's called Vastria. So this camp is much bigger. It's way more secluded. It's in the woods somewhere where people have said that there is high risk for fires similar to Moria. It's 4 hectares of this forest area that was cleared to create these prefabricated containers, and it's designed to house up to 5,000 asylum seekers. There's barbed wire fencing, high-tech surveillance. It is probably going to be the largest detention center in Europe, and it had the budget of 76 million euros that was funded by the EU to build the center. So the opening of the center has been a big thing that's been discussed in the NGO field for the past few years, because it would devastate the services that are available. It would make it so hard for people to access services. Everything would be more highly surveilled. It would really limit agency, autonomy, access. It's not a humane way for people who are arriving. And at the moment right now as well, there has been a big shift just in the Europe in general towards criminalization of immigration and just anti-immigration sentiments. And that's fueling a lot of discrimination, racism, and also a lot of fear. Like, we feel that with the refugees that are arriving here, and it's very much part of our conversations here. In the past year, arrivals have gone down in Lesbos. People are arriving to the other Greek islands like Samos and Chios. That could be because the journey to Lesbos is getting more dangerous and more surveilled, and so they are finding other paths or other routes to arrive. And I think the main, just to close it off, like the main thing that everyone on Lesbos is talking about right now is the recent EU pact on migration that has been passed. And it does talk to the criminalization of immigration, basically, and that their crime is crossing borders and fleeing wars, and that the main thing that they're trying to create is more fear and anxiety for refugees, that they can be deported into third countries outside of the EU that are called return hubs. So like refugees who are being rejected their asylum status will be sent to third countries that they don't even have any knowledge of. And this is really something that people are talking about in Lesbos at the moment.
Okay, very long answer.
Yeah.
Of course, yeah. There's, but it's there. Good to keep up with what is going on there. You also told me before, what was interesting is that there are fewer helping programs there right now. So why is that so, and what does that do?
Yeah, because the numbers in the camps have gone down compared to recent years, people are translating that as there is a lack of need. I think a lot of funders communicate through numbers. And so if you can't communicate your impact, so if your impact is you're benefiting 500 people instead of 5,000, they would say that there's less of a need there and they are moving their funding elsewhere. So a lot of nonprofits, organizations have closed down because of the lack of funding, as well as since the cut of US aid and all of these things. Like, it's just been really bad for nonprofits in general, regardless of the need or the amount of people in the camps currently. But people are still arriving. And one of the ways to look at it is that there are still people arriving. The people still need support. And actually, the people who do arrive have probably gone through so much more to actually get here. And from a qualitative sense, they probably do need more support. And also with there being less organizations around, less support available, you really have to think about innovative ways or cost-efficient ways or just how to use the limited resources you have to actually still provide people the support that they very much still need.
Mm. And can you tell me what your personal situation is like? You are trying to build a new program on your own, but how do you make a living at the moment?
So me and my husband, obviously, we started Mantle, and it kind of happened organically. We were just trying to figure out that question, how do we make a living? How do we survive while trying to do something we are passionate about, something that we really believe can make a difference? And that question culminated in this answer of, okay, let's try and be an organization. Let's try to seek grants. Let's work with other organizations. So at the moment, how do we make a living? We are seeking fundings, applying for lots of grants. We currently have a fundraiser. We're trying to fundraise for the program. We're making a living the way most new organizations do, on dreams and savings, I guess. But I guess the plan is obviously to be able to really establish ourselves, to prove that what we're doing is important and in worth funding, and seeking the right people who will help us get there.
Yeah. Okay. I guess that's really hard. But I mean, you are doing it. So somehow you must see that it's possible.
There are days when it feels more possible than other days. Our main strategy really is to cut down our life, scale everything back. And I mean, we wanted to do this anyways. When we first quit our jobs, we got a van and we wanted to just live a more minimalist life. And so I think this is one of like the sacrifices that we're making, is just living a life that costs less so we can prioritize the things that we value more and do more of that. So we don't know if it's actually gonna work out. It is like the worst time in all of history to start a non-profit, I suppose. when funding are drying up, and we are trying to also, you know, collaborate with different collectives and organizations. We're trying to run workshops, maybe with like climbing festivals, and not just work within this nonprofit sector, but to bring the ideas and the lessons that we learn in these spaces to the wider climbing community, to not just because maybe there's more money there, but just to bridge, like the main driver is to bridge this gap between these two worlds, because I don't think change happens in silos. It's not about just giving support to people who are displaced and marginalized while the rest of the world continue on. I think we need to have a narrower gap between these two worlds. We are all part of the same world, and I think that's the message, you know?
Yeah. And we will later talk about how every one of us, everyone who's listening, can also help you. At first, about the new program. Mm-hmm. You told me you analyzed the situation of the people on Lesbos and you asked what would help them. How could climbing help them? What were your conclusions?
Yeah, I've been on Lesbos for the past year, working closely with organizations that have been here for years. So, for example, our partner organization, Yoga and Sports with Refugees, they've been established for the past 6 years on the island, and they've been working alongside the refugees and the displaced people here for a long time, bringing sport into this context. And obviously, they have a wealth of knowledge. The nice thing about Lesbos is it's a small community. You get to network with other humanitarians that are here. You get to really see what people are doing. And I guess the first question I asked was, yeah, what could be helpful? So to understand when people arrive on Lesbos, this is not their end goal. A lot of people want to get to different parts of Europe. And this is very much like a transitionary place. People stay 3 months to 6 months. Some people do stay a year and longer, and some people do decide to settle down in Lesbos fully, but in general, it's a transitionary space. So you're kind of thinking, like, from a mental health perspective, like, what would actually help people when they are in transitionary phase, when they are focused on bureaucracy, getting the right papers, and you just focus on the next step and getting to the next place. And that's a hard question to answer, because obviously every single person's experience is not the same. And, you know, part of answering this question, or maybe part of asking what can climbing provide in these kind of situations, is also working together with other mental health professionals that work on the island, understanding the kind of support that they provide, trying to think what is something that climbing can provide that complements the work that they do but doesn't replicate it. And obviously the fact that climbing is movement-based, it brings you outdoors, it's something that allows you to work your body, it's a physical activity, it doesn't have the stigma of a mental health intervention. And all of these things are the strength of what climbing has. And I guess when I was trying to answer what could be the most helpful thing, if I could only give one thing to someone who goes through our climbing program that they are going to bring with them to the next country they go to or whatever they do, the idea that I kind of came up with was hope. Just because I think it's really difficult when they, even if they get a positive answer and they have legal status to stay in Europe, that isn't the end of their journey at all. Even if they travel to Germany, for example, and seek asylum in Germany, they're in a country where they don't speak the language, they don't have friends or family resources. It's a continuous uphill battle, and the odds are stacked against them. And when you're feeling a lot of despair and you've already been through so much just to get to this point, to start again from zero, I think like the only thing that gets people to wake up again in the morning and keep moving forward is the hope that something better awaits them. So I think that's the general sentiment behind how I came up with Climb for Hope, which is the program that we created here for refugees on Lesbos.
And can you give us some details of this program? So what steps are you planning? What will the people go through in your climbing sessions?
Yeah, so people will be referred to us from our mental health partners. So they're usually people who maybe have been seen by mental health professionals for maybe like more somatic or physical symptoms that they're flagged as this could be maybe trauma related, or they could benefit with something mental health related, or maybe someone who have gone through some one-to-one intervention and could benefit from a group context, or maybe just anyone that are in the camp that have been seen by other organizations in the camp and they feel like, oh, they could probably benefit from a more physical group-based intervention. And what we do on the practical sense is 4 sessions indoors and 1 outdoor session. And it's building on this idea of hope in a cognitive sense. So that hope is not just this fleeting feeling you get. You wake up one day and you're feeling hopeful. You wake up another day and you're not hopeful. But building on this hope theory that there are cognitive building blocks to hope. So how does someone build hope as a practice? And it's this idea of having problem solving, identity formation, emotional regulation, and relational connection. So this is like an oversimplification of like the kind of research behind it. But the idea is that by working on these 4 little elements, you're able to instill or reconnect a sense of hope. And they're such nice goals to work with climbing, because obviously problem solving, that's such a nice one. We do that all the time in climbing. And being able to kind of relate that to everyday realities, emotional regulation. So there's so many moments on the wall where you're going for the big dynamic move, for example, and you're feeling, you know, your palms get a little bit sweaty or you're a little bit afraid that you might fall. So being able to reflect on, okay, what were your bodily responses to uncertainty in that moment? What did you do that helped you go for the move anyway? Was it people cheering you on? Was it taking a deep breath? And like working on these within the session. So they have the climbing, they have a little like reflection break where everybody gets to share, and then they get to work on it again and amplify what they've learned and hopefully bring it out to their everyday life. And the idea would be that by the end of the 4 sessions, on top of learning like the basic foundations of climbing, your footwork, spotting for each other and all of these different things, that they get to go outdoors and they get to use all of the little tools that they've learned to send an outdoor climbing route. And they get to be at the top and see themselves from a different perspective and also look at the landscape, like the place where we climb in Lesbos. It basically looks out onto the sea that they've traveled to get to Lesbos. And the idea is that they go through this whole journey on the way up to the route, moments of uncertainty, believing in themselves, taking one step at a time. They reach the top. They didn't think they could achieve something. So it's giving them a different perspective to themselves, but also looking out on the journey that they've taken to become this person and having a different perspective on that. So that's the dream. That's the general idea.
And you're saying that's the dream because you haven't started yet. You are still trying to collect the money to do that work.
Yeah. So for the past year, we've done all the research. We've had partners in place. We've done focus group discussions where we test out the sessions with mental health professionals. We've done everything we can to make this the best that we can do with our given resources. And we were supposed to start last year, but we had issues with funding where we lost the climbing wall at one point and we had to rebuild the climbing wall again. So this is just the nature of, I guess, of working in like the nonprofit sector where things are really uncertain. People can lose funding within the next month. So now we finally have a beautiful wall. We have people who are willing to support us in the implementation of the program, but we need money to be able to pay for the van, to drive outdoors, to be able to train volunteers, to be able to run this program in a safe way, to get snacks, you know, things just cost money. And so that's the premise of why we're fundraising at the moment, so we can run this program and really see its impact and understand what we can do with this.
Is any part of the program something that you have learned in Lebanon where you say, okay, I know that this is working, I did this before, I saw this before?
I think the idea of structured climbing sessions is something that I know works based on all of the research that exists about bouldering psychotherapy as an intervention. And even though obviously bouldering psychotherapy uses cognitive behavioral therapy, and that's something that I'm not using in this context because we don't have access to a lot of psychotherapists. And the idea is to work with what resources are available and how can we train lay people to be able to provide something therapeutic without being a therapist and offering therapy per se. And so designing this program involved understanding the context we are in, what capacity do organizations have, what resources actually exist, and working with that. So a lot of the framing is different, but I think the main kind of pillars, the idea of a structured intervention, the idea of working on a psychosocial goal through climbing, using experiential learning, like all of these things are tried and tested in outdoor education, not just in climbing, but like adventure therapy, mm-hmm. outdoor education. These are all tried and tested ways. I think the only part that's innovative on my end is using hope as the psychosocial goal, using these mm-hmm. four cognitive building blocks that we research has formed are the building blocks of hope. And using this program in this context where we're actually working with people from so many different cultures. So I think the program in Lebanon was very much working with Syrians and Lebanese who both spoke Arabic, who both come from a very similar culture. And now I'm working in a context where we have refugees coming from Sudan, Sierra Leone, Palestine, Congo, like it's different cultures, different languages, and the program had to be flexible in that as well. So there's definitely a lot of innovation that needed to be done because the context demanded it. But the backbone that makes it effective, or that makes me believe it will be effective, all of these things are evidence-based, and I've seen it being tried and tested.
Mm. And to build up the program, have you talked to people on Lesbos? Have you talked to refugees or other helping organizations to find out what would be the best idea, what would fit?
Yeah, definitely. A big part of it is talking to the mental health organizations on the ground. So there's a French organization called Therapsy. There's a Dutch organization called Boat Refugee Foundation, and they've been here for years. They work within the camp as well as outside of the camp. And understanding the work of understanding the mental health landscape was something that I really took time to do because I didn't want to create something that wasn't needed, that wasn't adding value to what already existed. And definitely, like, what's different about our intervention is the idea that it is a group intervention. It's non-stigmatizing. It brings in this element of physical activity. It's probably targeting a different demographic to the people who would attend one-to-one psychosocial support. A lot of the time as well, people don't think that they need to see a psychiatrist because they don't think they're mentally ill. Of course, they're depressed, of course they're angry, but that's because of the circumstances that they're in, and it's a normal response to that. And I think what I'm trying to create is something that speaks to that, that understands that, like, just because all of this is not your fault and it's out of your control doesn't mean that you won't benefit from the support of others and understanding yourself and having space for yourself and reconnecting with hope. And that doesn't mean it's because you're mentally ill or crazy or any of that. And totally acknowledging that the reason why people are struggling with their mental health in this context is not necessarily because they have a biological illness, but very much because of the systemic difficulties that are stacked against them.
Yeah. And there's one question that I know you are also hearing a lot. How important is it to offer, for example, climbing to these people if there's other things that they might need, like they need space for them, like they need a house, they need better food, better medical care. Mm-hmm. So is climbing really a priority? Why is it important to do that?
Yes, if they are starving, I'm not going to get them to climb my bouldering route and say this is going to fix their problem 100%. We need to give them food. We need to give them housing. We need to give them medical support. We need to give them administrative support because that's their biggest priority. And we need to give them mental health support. Like, I think we need to give them all the support. But also a lot of the people here are spending most of your days waiting to know what the decision is. And they're waiting in anxiety, and they're waiting in what ifs. And climbing is something that for some people might help them forget about that, might help them pass the time, might help them take care of themselves. And I think as well, another thing that people don't really put enough value on, maybe because it's something you can't enumerate, like money, but it's care. And there's a lot of like intangible things that carry a lot of value, like care, offering care to people, offering kindness. And this is something that I'm hoping this context will create. Kindness between two people. I think people who go through this journey learn not to trust people. And also, people always assume that joy is a frivolous thing and is only reserved for people who have money and have all of their needs met. But after food and water, we need belonging. And why do they only need to survive? Why are they always only in survival mode? Why can't they also experience joy? Why is that not also just as important? And I think those are the questions that I think about when I question if this will bring any good.
Mm-hmm. To start this project, we have already said you still need money. And you have an idea how everyone, also the people listening here, can help. At first, where are you standing at the moment? How much funding do you have already?
Yeah, so at the moment for this pilot, we are totally fundraising from scratch. And yeah, at the moment we are about 500 euros into our final goal. The ideal amount would be to get 3,000 euros, but we will go ahead with the project regardless of how much we have. It'll just mean we'll have to make little cutbacks and reprioritize certain things.
So you want to make 3,000 euros right now?
Yeah.
You need those for a month, for a year, or?
Yeah, so this 3,000 euros is to run a whole cycle, and that would last up to about 5 months. And that includes basically just the in and out of being able to run the program, the day-to-day stuff. It's also paying for transportation. It's supporting also the monitoring and evaluation process. And that means like simple things like being able to print out paper or print out nice visuals and laminate it, like really mundane things that also cost money. But then also the wider work of like really testing what we're doing and seeing the impact and seeing if it's safe. All of the time of coordinating something like this, outreach, providing snacks for the day, getting people to support, gear, gym space.
Yeah. Okay. And you have an idea how to fundraise like all over Europe or yeah, everywhere where they have a climbing or a bouldering gym.
Yeah.
For example, also here in Germany. So every gym can be a part of it. And your idea is that the gym set up a mental boulder. Mm-hmm. So mental, like the name of your project. So it should be a boulder with a mentaling move.
Yeah.
And if you want to climb that boulder, you have to give a little donation for the project. So question is, are there already gyms taking part? And how are the people reacting to this idea?
Yeah, the idea is really we want to just mobilize as many climbers as possible to come together to support climbers here on Lesbos to be able to climb. And so our tagline is to mental for mental health. And we just want any gym that would like to support us to set one route. So donate a boulder to our cause. It has to have a mental move, and then people get to mental for mental health, basically. And at the moment we have 6 gyms. The response has been good. It is like a busy period. I feel like every gym at the moment has some event and all these different things. So I think when people don't participate, it's been because they have so many events happening and not because they wouldn't want to support it. The general feedback has been really nice. And it's been so nice to have so many support from the Berlin climbing community.
Cool.
Yeah. So Berlin is definitely winning on the number of gyms getting involved in this. So bravo, you guys.
So, and what can anyone do who's listening right now? So what would you say? So your last words.
I mean, two things. One, harass your climbing gyms to get them to set it up. So on our Instagram, we said that it's running until the 20th of July, but we're really happy to extend the fundraiser for as long as gyms want to participate and support. So if you go to your local climbing gym and you're ready to share about our initiative, that would mean a lot. And you can find our links at our Instagram, which is mental.climb. And you can also donate there directly if you're not a climber or you can't climb or if your gym won't set up a mental for us. But also on a wider scale, like zooming out, as a newer organization, I think just having support is a huge thing. So if anything that I've shared resonates with any of you, please reach out. Like, even if you're, especially if you're working towards the same goal, because there's so many people in the climbing community who are also doing something for mental health, for well-being, with movement, for social good. And I know, like, the world is so huge, and I just want a way for us to be able to be all connected, collaborate. I really think, like, we're so much stronger when we're all working together. And I have so many big dreams for mental, and I think the only way we'll get there is if we're all coming together. And I think that also talks to my whole idea of having this big community of climbers who care. So if you can't give in money, if you can't give in your time and energy harassing your climbing gym, even just like reaching out and seeing how we can collaborate, how we can make our network closer is something I would super, super appreciate.
Okay. Now, Biha, it was really interesting talking to you and hearing about the life situations that we don't know too much about. But it's true what you said, that we all belong together. We are all living in this world, and it's important that we help each other, even if we don't know each other.
Sure. Before we end, though,
yeah.
I was wondering if it's okay if I read something. It was an essay written by a refugee who would like to remain anonymous on Lesbos here. I wanted him to actually record him reading it, but I guess there's a lot of fear around if people found out who he was, if it would affect his process. And this is just how people live in this day, but he would be happy for me to share it with you all. So if I could read it, would that be okay?
Yeah.
So it's called Beyond the Word Refugee. When we speak of courage, we are not merely repeating a beautiful word written on a banner. We are talking about our shattered souls and our memories that bleed every single day. As refugees, we did not tear ourselves from our roots by choice. We were thrown into this destiny against our will. Believe me, if wars and injustice had not torn our homelands apart, we would have never chosen to walk this path of death. We would have stayed there in our warm homes, surrounded by the laughter of our families and the safety of our small details. But instead, we found ourselves forced to flee the destruction, only to be caught by the waves of a dark, cold, and terrifying sea. In those moments, amidst the crashing waves, I stood face to face with death. I was frozen with terror, completely helpless, drowning in absolute fear. In that darkness, I could hear nothing but the pounding of my heart and the sound of the breath around me, praying for a shred of hope, for a shore that would simply respect their humanity. We risked everything, our entire existence, not to ask for wealth, but to wrench our right to a simple, dignified life that every human being is born deserving. But take it from me as a truth stained with pain. The cruelty of that freezing sea and the terror of drowning is nothing compared to the agony after survival, the deepest pain, the ache that chokes the soul every morning is this long, deadly exile. To live alone, separated by seas, borders, and a harsh silence from your family and loved ones who are your entire world. To long for the people closest to you, carrying their absence as a chokehold in your throat with every breath your chest takes, without knowing when you will ever catch a glimpse of your faces again. This longing is the slow death we leave behind, our silent features. We do not ask you for pity. We ask this world to feel us. We wish for you and for everyone we have come to live among to look beyond the word refugee. Look at our humanity, at our big dreams that shattered on the rocks and at the heavy, exhausted hearts we carry on our chests. Our standing here today with this community proves that within all this brokenness and pain, there is a hope that refuses to die. Our being together and our connection is what heals our wounds. And we are here to say to the entire world, we may be broken and burdened with pain, but our courage and our will to live can never, ever be broken.
Thank you very much to this person to let us understand what he's going through and so many others.
Thanks for giving us the time to read it.
So again, thank you for this interview. And I hope that a lot of people will listen and share.
Yeah, me too. Thank you so much, Juliana, for your time.
This was Nabia Razak here on Bin Weg Bouldern. I will put all the links to Nabia's project into the show notes. And I thank you all for listening. And I guess Nabia will thank you for sharing her idea. This is it for this episode. I hope you will come back for the next one. Juliana, mein Name, und ich bin wegbouldern.